to everybody. I'm in this moment feeling excited, looking forward to sharing this information with people. Let me just take a moment and tell you briefly kind of an overview of things. We have 8 meetings, and I'm very much looking forward to sharing this material with you. I want just to say that my overall excitement and desire would be that this somehow lands in ways that really has some long-term contribution to your well-being and your ability to live life from a place that really brings satisfaction. So one of the things that stimulated me to move in this direction was all the incredible, exciting breakthroughs that have happened in researching the brain in the last 15 years or so. In many ways, it verifies everything we've already known for years and practiced in NVC. It has verified, for example, that empathy does, in fact, have a deeply calming effect on the parts of the brain, or a part of the brain at any rate, that gets activated when we're triggered. So that it has added to the conceptual information of what are patterns, chronic patterns of pain, chronic triggers like, you know, getting angry, and I'm sure that's not you deciding to get angry, it just kind of happens. So that's a triggered anger. And lots more. So this all kind of really galvanized me to kind of try to put it together about where did jackals come from, how do we originate our belief structures, what's going on in the brain, and I am hoping this kind of potpourri of information and approaches will contribute to you in the way it has to me, which is I may be a teacher, but believe me, I am still a learner and I'm still working on my own stuff. So I've had just tremendous success that has just galvanized me, and it's put a whole new shot of excitement in my arm. So in the first half, you know, don't hold me to this exactly, but in say the first 4 sessions, I'll be introducing information that's actually critical as a foundation to doing healing work, whether that's with yourself or with another person. Then the second half, we'll focus primarily on doing the actual process work and healing work. Specifically today, I'm planning to take us into 2 arenas. One is the living energy of needs, because understanding and being able to channel this kind of energy in your body is actually critical to the healing process. And the second focus for our session today will be taking a look at when we're little babies and little kitties, what is it that we primarily need? I want to go over these stages in early childhood development with you because, again, at the point when we start working with those parts of ourselves that got traumatized or were wounded or have disconnected in some way, it's really critical to understand what the primary needs were that never got met, because they can still be met at this late date. That's really the amazing thing about all of this. That's pretty much the overview that I wanted to give you. I guess I would just like to take a moment for each of us to stop for a moment. I am a great believer in clarity of intention. And I would like each of you, if you would, to get a piece of paper and something to write with. And we'll just take maybe 3 minutes for you to really kind of go inside yourself and create 1 or 2 intentions for the work that we'll be doing together over the next 8 weeks. I'd like to just tell you what an intention is in my reality, and that is an intention is actually a decision. It's a decision. They can be a conscious decision or an unconscious decision. In this case, I'm asking you to make a conscious decision. So it's a decision, whether conscious or not conscious, to produce and or experience an effect or an outcome. I'll say that one more time. A decision, conscious or not conscious, to produce and or experience an outcome or effect. Before you each actually start to take a look at what your intentions are for this time, I would like to say 1 or 2 other quick things about it. You need to be careful not to put a negative intention, like I want to stop being angry, for example, or I want to stop having relationships that don't work. It's critical to say what you do want. The good tooth fairy can't give you what you don't want. It's going to only give you if you say what you do want. So your intention would be to, let's say, experience blah, blah, whatever it might be in the positive. And the other thing you want to be careful about with intentions is not to say, I'd like to feel a little more this or that, or I'd like a little better ability to choose. Don't do little bits. You want to go to the end point. That's your intention. What's the outcome that you want, period. Okay? Okay, so I'm going to start now with our first topic, which is needs, specifically needs as living, energetic life flows. I'd like to give you my definition of need. It seems to work for me and a lot of people I've shared with, and that is that a need is a quality which, when experienced, enhances life, or you could say enhances well-being. So a quality which, when experienced, enhances life. In my many years of floating around this amazing planet and connecting with different people, one consistent thing that I and many of my fellow trainers have encountered is people in NVC circles who are empathizing, but empathizing in a way that we're hearing words rather than life energies. I spent a number of years trying to figure out what this was all about. And eventually I came up with this understanding that needs have nothing to do with words. They have to do with these qualities. And these qualities can be symbolized by a word, but they cannot be lived by a word. So that when I speak to somebody and I say, oh, you're just really, really needing some rest and some relaxation and some care, that is actually a living energy that I have experienced within myself. And then I am allowing my words to flow from that experience. So these living energies have the potential to heal trauma, repair the brain, and create a state of well-being, which is an amazing thing that has now been verified through brain research. Words alone won't do it. So with the best of intentions, people can be saying the words that they think are the words of empathy, but if this life quality isn't in it, then it actually does not resonate in the way that gets into the systems, our systems, both our own and other people. It's the life, the energy, not the words. And as an aside, I'd just like to say, those of you to whom, I know there are some people on the call for whom this is familiar, and I hope you all will just practice this in the way you would practice a treasured instrument. You can always get more sound and resonance. But for those of you to whom it's new, I think you're aware that there is a full-length CD on this that goes into much more depth, which is available. And if you aren't familiar with it, I would highly recommend listening to it. So what I'd like to do is, without much further ado, is actually jump in and practice the difference between saying a word, a need, saying a word that represents a need, saying it as just a word without life, so in a certain sense mechanically or in a dead sort of a way, and saying the word when you have taken the time first to really feel inside your body what the beautiful quality is that this word represents. We're going to start with one that I think is relatively easy for most people to begin with, and that is the need for rest. Before we even do anything with it, I'd like each of you to take a few conscious breaths. So if you would just let your bodies relax, just kind of drop down out of your headspace, you know, almost as if you just kind of feel your attention lowering into your body below your neck. And then just breathe normally, but put your attention just on the breathing itself. And notice the inhale. And notice the exhale. Notice any sensations that may be occurring in your body. And if you find that you're thinking a thought or feeling something or seeing an image of some kind, that's okay. No judgments, just gently bring your attention back to your breathing. Great. Okay. So from this place now, where we have moved our awareness to a more internal locus, I'd like you all to just think about rest, the quality of rest. What is that like? You can use any device to get yourself to this place, but where we're wanting to go is to feel it in your body, inside your body. What happens when you are experiencing the beauty of rest? You can make up a story, like one that works pretty well is you've been out, say, hiking, doing something strenuous for several days. It was great. You're home now. Your body is very tired. You feel really good. You've taken a nice shower or bath. And now you're about to lie down and rest. So just notice when you're in that energy, what's happening in your face, what's happening in your body, how do your toes feel, how do your fingers feel? This beautiful, beautiful sense, experience of rest. So now, what I'd like everybody to do now is all together, when I say the word go, I want you to stay with this quality that you're with and say the word rest, allowing it to just flow from this energy. Okay? So I'm going to say go. What I'd like you to practice now is going from that back into just saying it as a word. So now I want you to let go of that energy. Disconnect from it. And now just individually by yourself, out loud, just say the word rest. And I'm going to model this so you can hear the difference. So with energy, it's rest. And without energy, it's rest. So, for example, if I were empathizing, I'd say, oh, are you really, really just dying to get some rest? That would be with the energy. Other ones that I'd say, oh, are you tired and you really need some rest? I think you could hear the difference there. So now, say it out loud, now without energy, each of you, individually. Okay. And now I'd like you to take your time with this, but to feel the quality of it again inside your body. Go through that dropping down out of your head into your body. Sometimes it helps just to notice what your body's doing. Like if I tune in, I can feel some tingling in my toes right now, a little in my hands. And now I'm just going to go and say, internally really move into, it's almost like I'm bathing in this beautiful energy of rest. And take a few more seconds just really to get into that. Let it expand through your body. Your whole body feels this precious energy of rest. And now say it out loud with the energy. And then let go altogether. And let go of all the energy and just let it be a word and say it out loud. Just a word. And now I'd like you all for just a minute or so to just go back and forth. Say rest with life force in it and then say it as a mechanical empty word, a dead word. I'm going to take 60 seconds, about a minute, to do that. Okay. Good. So I guess I'd like to take a few minutes now to just hear from anybody. Are you able to feel the difference between living energy and when we're just absent and not putting any consciousness into a word that represents the need?
The difference for me was that my voice dropped when I was going with the living energy of the need, and it was much lower pitched, and it felt like there was much more substance to it, like the energy had depth, wanted me to follow it down, whereas without it, it was clipped and higher pitched, and it felt very shallow.
Yes, thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to share?
In order for me to be able to say it with the energy, I had to actually rest myself. I had to take a deep breath and actually feel rested in order for me to say it that way.
Exactly. Yeah, and that is in fact what you really need to do, is to actually go into the experience of the need internally before we say it externally. That is, if you're talking to another, as you can also be talking to yourself empathically. I love that. Thank you so much.
There was a real connection with the body when
yes.
I said it with the living energy. It was like there was oneness with the body, whereas otherwise it was just a mental.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you very much. And let's have one more person now.
What surprised me was after I'd gone into my body and become rested and said rest that way, that I had to really work to get back to saying it mechanically.
Yeah, you know, sometimes when we do this in groups and I say, okay, now let go of the energy and you know, it's like, oh no, we don't want to. But I will tell you why this back and forth. In fact, it's very much like a Nautilus exercise. When you can create something and then let go of it and create it and let go of it and create it and let go of it, that is ultimately going to give you a lot more ability in the moment when you want to create it. It just gives you practice creating. Now, if we had all the time in the world, you know, I'd have us be doing this for the next half an hour with different needs. But I'm going to leave it to those of you for whom this is new, and even those of you that want to continue practice, you can take any need. I started with rest because it's a physical need, and therefore it's usually a little easier for people to get it in their body because it is a physical kind of thing. And another one like that is affection. Affection is a very physical, very warm kind of a quality. So if you just take a moment right now, think about affection, the need for affection. Just if you drop down into your body and you think about this affection, what is that like? Now, sometimes I even say, maybe take your hand and touch your cheek in kind of an affectionate way. And notice what your body is doing. Most often what we get feedback on, and what I certainly have experienced myself, is if you are truly allowing that, it's almost like there's a universal flow that you're plugging into. It's the wavelength of affection. You're plugging into this affection and letting it just flood through your body. And generally with affection, when people are truly in it, they're feeling warmth. They usually feel some sensation or openness kind of in the heart center. And very often there's a smile on the face. So I would, as I said, if we had an unlimited amount of time, I would love to practice this more with all of you, but I would encourage you to practice this at home. And for now, what I'd like to do, though, is a paired exercise with this. So this is just another simple practice exercise. So you'll have two of you, and we'll just say A and B. So A, you will pick a need. A need that's alive in your life, a need that means something to you, that's important to you. And let your partner know which need you're choosing. And then both of you just sit together and go into the living energy of that need for about 3 minutes. A has told B the need, and B, you are just there to support. So there's no speaking. It's really important that we don't want to get into talking. This is a kind of really body soul-centered exercise. So both of you will be in the energy of this need, and then Stephanie will let you know when it's time to switch, and then you just repeat the same thing on the other side. And at the end, both of you have a chance to debrief with one another. So I hope I said that clearly. You're going to choose a need that's important to you, and both of you are going to sit and feel the energy of that. Then you'll switch, and your partner will tell you what need she or he has chosen, and then you both sit with that. We call it the meditation on the living energy of needs. All right, so let's start. Okay, so the take-home piece from this is this, that in order to create internal healing that actually works, and by work, I mean it stays stable, the energy that we use needs to be alive and intense. Otherwise, it doesn't get picked up by the system that needs to pick it up. And I'll go into this in future sessions so that it's all much more clear. I'm wanting you to understand why we're taking time to really, and why I said said as a prerequisite that the living energy of needs is critical to actually doing the work. The two main flows that are healing are empathy and compassion, but they are useless unless they're alive. And a lot of people, I know I've heard it once, I've heard it 100 times, is people say to me, you know, I can empathize with other people, but it's really hard for me to feel my own empathy internally. And that's like, whoa, bingo, that is the piece. You know, if we can't get this intensity, this quality of actual a felt sense of energy moving through our bodies, if we cannot do that internally, then we will not have the communication tool that's required to actually reach the part of the brain that we need to reach. And this is one of the pieces that explains so much. Those of us who have been in therapy one or more times in our lives, talk therapy can be very supportive, and it is, and especially if you have a naturally empathic therapist. And there are many of those. But unfortunately, there is also a lot of therapy that goes on which is talking about stuff or just simply emoting, but does not have the, it's like the left side of the brain, which is the side that's conscious and talks and, you know, is rational, it's talking to itself. Unless you find the new route into these traumatized and dissociated places, and that's really the whole kind of crux of our time together. So I hope that little sense of where we're going with this is interesting to you and maybe even a little tantalizing. It certainly tantalized to me. So we're going to move into the second part of this. So we're going to shift topics now and talk about the developmental phases in terms of needs, basic needs of children and babies. The earliest stage of, now these are approximate time frames, right, because kids don't all develop exactly the same. So this first is basically the first year. It can go to around 12 months, 13 months. The primary need there is, and I'm going to say it in a minute, but just I want to give you a few seconds to just think. Use your living energy of needs. You're a baby. You're an infant. What is your primary need? There are, of course, many needs, but the primary and overriding need in infancy is bonding. It's just built into the human system. It's built into the mammalian system that if somebody's not holding on to you or you're not holding on to somebody, you're not likely to survive. I mean, it's not a thought thing, but it's a felt thing in the body. So I don't know if some of you may have seen, was circulated on the internet some time ago, this absolutely amazing photograph of a surgeon who was doing surgery on a woman and who was pregnant, and he had made an incision into the uterus, and out of this uterus is poking this teeny tiny little hand, and it has a hold of the surgeon's gloved thumb, and it's just clutching this thumb, just this little arm sticking out of this woman's body. It's like the first instinct. If there's something there, it's going to grab it. And that's the need for bonding. So what's the energetics of bonding? When you're an infant and you're bonded, it's almost like your body is still able, your body or whatever else is there, the early emotional system, it's still able to kind of maintain the sense of being merged in a safe place. Just that sense of just being united with something and being almost like enmeshed and in a universal, and you know, if you can imagine what it's like in the womb, since you're in warm water and you're floating and it's dark and it's safe. And so that little body that gets born, it's really wanting to continue that a lot of the time, that bonded feeling. So we could say a lot more about that, but that's just though the first year, it's a primary need. So then as the child gets older, and we're moving now into, say, roughly 12 months to 3 and 4, maybe, the primary need in this developmental stage is unconditional love with boundaries. So what that means is that the child has experienced an unbroken flow of love. And that doesn't mean, as talking about the terrible twos and threes, and well, this is a time a child is actively really, really exploring. And so it means that when boundaries are set, if a parent says, I'd like you to put down that piece of whatever, it can break very easily. If it's said with unconditional love, then it's easy to set boundaries with children that are not damaging or traumatizing. So that's the sense of unconditional love and boundaries together, as opposed to what generally comes to children in the domination culture, where we get a lot of, you know, don't do that, stop doing that, what's the matter with you, no, 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 where there may well be love present, but it will not be felt by the child. So they start to hear these corrections as punitive or upsetting or in some cases traumatizing, even when there is a basic goodwill on the part of the parent or basic emotional, you know, availability of the child. Now, so when we're talking about abusive parents, then we get into a real damaging territory. So here is an exploring child reaching out, taking steps, looking at new things. Every moment of present time is new and different and completely in the moment. And when that consistently gets interrupted by disconnected angry energy or neglectful energy, then you start to get children in states of confusion, bewilderment, and the whole cycle that we'll talk more about next time begins. So then the last of the early stages, again, I'm not trying to say all the needs. Obviously, children have many, many needs all the time, and I'm obviously totally not addressing the obvious, like physical needs for eating and sleeping and so on and so forth. But I'm talking about primary developmental needs, that if a child is progressing, it will move very naturally from the bonding phase into the unconditional love phase, where it's exploring and developing boundaries and even developing, say, the beginnings of empathy in that second stage, learning that there's not just one big I, but there's an IU, and then there's an I many U's starting to happen. And then finally, this third stage, going basically from somewhere between 3 and 4 up to 6 or 7. And this is an active kind of socializing phase for children, learning to relate more as individuals with others. They've, of course, have related with parents up until now and probably with siblings. But now we're sort of getting into the years where children are playing with others and beginning really to focus more with self-expression, developing their own identity. It's typically a time when kids have a lot of creative energy, you know, dancing energy, doing things the adult generation may no longer identify with that they find very entertaining, differentiating, and then also really deepening into that I-you mutuality, that I'm here, but there's also other people here. So those are the kind of basic phases that all of us go through. And I just wanted to spend a little bit of time identifying those so that later when we do the dialogues with internal parts of ourselves that have been hurt, if not outright traumatized, you have a sense that at a certain stage, if it's a very, very young child, it's going to need all those bonding things, which include, you know, being held and having that kind of quality of eye contact where an infant kind of really gets a sense that it exists. And if it's a slightly older child, then you know that whatever is going on, it needs the support of unconditional love, but you're in a stage where you can actually start to articulate needs which differ from the child's, and so on. So I want to take a little bit of time with that, and I think I'll stop for the moment and see if that was all pretty clear to people, or anybody have anything they would like to share at this point?
What was the third need? Up to 12 months it's bonding, and then 1 to 3 or 4 it's unconditional love with boundaries. And what was the need for the other one, the later phase?
Roughly 3 to 4 to 6 or 7. That's the need for socializing, relating with others, beginning to develop your own self-expression, your own identity, definitely differentiation. And you see, this is critical because when children are in environments which support their flourishing, their authenticity continues to evolve. But as is so often the case in the domination system, as you, I hope, probably all know, but if you don't, I'll just say it briefly. The educational part of domination system in the Western world is designed to break the spirit of children. And I could say a whole lot more about it, but if you're interested in getting a whole look at that, For Your Own Good by Alice Miller is a fantastic resource on that. So then let's move on to the next piece. This is where we're going to start to look at what I call core survival structures. That is a belief which are the attempt of a child to make sense out of its experience, its pain, or its bewilderment. When children are in situations, now there's several different things that can happen in childhood. There can be outright abuse. I hate that word, but I can't find a better word. So that can look like physical violence. It can be, obviously, sexual violation. I have worked with people who have had been sent away from the dinner table to stay out in the barn in the cold. The rest of the time, we know children are put in closets, children are tied up. It can go from mild to extreme forms of physical behaviors. Then there's emotional. Emotional is actually, you know, if you're a kid in a family that just hits once in a while, that's kind of predictable and you sort of learn to deal with it. That is actually probably less damaging in terms of long-term development than emotional abuse, because it's so hard for children to understand. I've worked with many, many people over the years in my private practice where they say, well, I came from a good home, my parents cared about me and this and that and the other thing, and it's hard for them to really give weight to the fact that their parents were emotionally dysregulated. And though their parents did care for them, there was still the equivalent of an emotional roller coaster, or in some cases, emotional dysfunction in parenting in adults will go in one of two directions. It's either chaotic, which is the sort of more expressive anger, you know, through hitting and all that other stuff, or there are parents who are in the rigid side of dysfunction, which is various forms of disattachment. So you can have parents who love their children very, very much, but actually do not have the channels of connection. And so these kids don't feel like anybody's there. And that is devastating to a child, especially in the bonding phases. So that's where there's either emotional or physical behavior and energy that's going on that's overt. But then there is also this kind of what is now known in the literature as impoverished environments, where there's neither physical violence nor outright emotional abuse, but there's just a kind of neglect. The parents may be very busy with their own lives. They hand off the children to various caretakers. That is also an environment in which young little humans do not flourish. They do not flourish in impoverished environments. There are all these possibilities for children's basic needs not to be met. So all of this stuff is happening to children, and they do not have a full brain. They don't even have the fully developed cortex of the brain. Doesn't really come online until age 6 or 7. So children are left largely to experiential realities, and they don't have a lot of clarity at, say, the intellectual level. Enough clarity to say, oh, well, I know my mom's had a hard life and she's really never had anybody to take care of her, so she's really not able to take care of me, and it's really not about me, you know, so I'm not going to take it personally. Doesn't happen. As a result, there is an incredible tendency on the part of children to internalize causality. If something's going wrong, they tend to think it has to do with them and their behavior. If they're not getting a need met, they tend to take the cause onto themselves and create a thought later. So you see, this is the early part. In these early years, it's more felt than consciously held as beliefs. As we get older and the reasoning part of the mind becomes stronger and stronger, and it's developing very strongly starting at age 6 and 7, then we have this weird thing that happens in our brain, which is the thinking part, which is the left part of the brain, starts to try to explain all this pain and all this internalized trauma, all the bewilderment and the fear and the confusion and the timidity and the lack of confidence, the shakiness that many children feel. This left side of the brain, part of its task is to make sense out of things. So it makes sense out of them by deciding certain things. And that's where our belief structures arise. So for example, I had a client who in the first 21 days of her life, she was breastfed. However, she was constantly crying and she failed to gain weight. She failed to flourish. And they couldn't figure out what was wrong. And it apparently took them 3 weeks, don't ask me why, to figure out that her mother's breast milk was chemically undigestible for this child. And so for 21 days, this little thing was literally starving and screaming. And of course, a newborn had no way of thinking or no way you could explain what was going on to it. I met this person when she was in her 50s, and I don't want to take a lot of time, but let me say she was on a severe downward spiral, depressed and semi-alcoholic. And as we worked and as I started to get to know her, the theme that kept coming forward from her words is, I'll never get what I want. I never get what I want. I never get what I need. I'll never get what I need. I'll never get what I need. This was so ingrained in her that came from that very, very early experience of never getting what she needed. So these experiences which children have, which are nightmarish or traumatic or negligent or absolutely demonic or mildly neglectful, whatever they are, these memories get stored in a certain part of the brain and they are easily triggered when anything similar starts to happen. So the origin of belief structures is an attempt on the part of a child to explain all this stuff that's been retained in experience and in memory that is not sorted out, that is not understood, it is not properly filed even in the brain. And so the child starts to make up ideas that explain it. And often they are negative conclusions about the child itself, which form the core of our negative belief structures that we carry with us, some people, through their entire lives. I'm bad. I'm repulsive. I did something wrong. There's something wrong with me. I'll never be enough. Something got left out of me. Something's missing. I'm sure many of you could contribute to these. I want to talk now then briefly about the two forms of beliefs. Beliefs are thinking, and you notice I'm not using the word jackal. I will tell you all, frankly, that as the years have gone by, I am less and less drawn to the word jackal. And that is jackal thinking, for example, our jackal thinking. And I will tell you that that is because I don't hear that as free of judgment. I hear that when people are saying jackals, there's almost always a sense that they're not good. You know, there's something wrong with them. They're the things I have to deal with. That's what I have to get rid of. Could I see a show of hands of people that sense yourself that jackal thinking carries a not okayness about it at some level. So I'm glad that so many of you share my experience of that. I've pretty much chosen to stop using the word jackal, though I don't want to make a judgment that it's a bad word. I mean, sometimes it's a useful word. I'd just like to talk about the kinds of belief structures that we develop. And There are the ones that I just mentioned, the sort of basic ideas about the self. I'm bad. I'm repulsive. I did something wrong. I'm not okay. I'll never be okay. I'll never be enough. And I'm sure you all could add quite a few more onto those. That's one type. But there's another type that I found very interesting when I learned about it. And we call that an unlivable contract. And they're unlivable because they suppress the natural life or the authentic essence, if you will, of a child. So I'll give you some examples. So let's say you're a kid and you're in a house and you're growing up in a home where every time you do something that is a little bit loud and a little bit creative, you get told to shut up or keep quiet, and not nicely, or even done abusively. Then many children, after a while, because their primary desire, and let's see, you're in the 2 to 3 range when this is happening, which is when it's likely to start happening, your basic need in that phase of development is unconditional love. And would you be quiet? Would you stop doing that? You're making too much noise. Doesn't really come across to children as unconditional love. So many, many children start to unconsciously, these never quite come to consciousness, develop these unconscious, unlivable contracts. If I keep quiet, maybe they'll love me. They'll love me. Maybe they'll love me if I keep quiet. If I'm invisible, maybe I'll survive. A lot of children in alcoholic households, growing up in alcoholic homes, they know the slightest thing can set off the alcoholic parent. And so they want to be, like, they just want to not be there. They want to be invisible because they don't provoke anything. So if I'm invisible, I'll survive. And then 40 years later, they don't understand why they're having such a hard time stepping up and becoming something they want to become that involves them to show themselves. Because it's registered deep down and in a place that they don't know is there, that is a threat to their actual survival. So that's a piece I haven't talked about yet, but we'll talk a little more clearly about it when we talk about trauma next week, that the systems of a child very often, if there's repeated emotional, really negative energy, toxic energy around it, will start to feel like if that keeps happening, it's like a threat to their survival, and they're up against some form of extinction. And that's why these adaptive behaviors come into play. They actually work to a large extent to get us through our childhood. So the thing is, getting back to my little talk about jackals, is I really want just to start us all off with honoring that force of life in little children that develops these shields and these beliefs and these persona, if you will, that allows them to protect something precious inside and survive. So these are not bad things. In fact, they were damn good when they happened at the time. Most of these little kids, we have no other choices. There aren't very many good alternatives. You can't vote for and elect a new set of parents, so you're pretty much stuck where you're stuck. And so to then, as adults, unconsciously start to level energy that is critical and resentful toward our own structures that got us through some really hairy times, it's not helpful. And it really doesn't honor the life force that developed them in the first place. So yes, they may not be functional. They may be impeding at this stage in our lives, and they may have impeded us for some time. But critical to healing them is to understand that they got put in place for a reason, not because there's something wrong with you, but because you were doing your best you could to get through something and live. I think I'd like to stop there, and I'll tell you a few more unlivable contracts. If I'm good, if I'm a good girl, if I'm a good boy, they'll love me. If I'm responsible, maybe they'll love me. If I suppress my feelings, maybe they'll accept me. And if I keep quiet, maybe I'll be safe. So these are some examples of unlivable contracts. You'll notice that they always come in this form. So I'm going to ask you in a minute to do a breakout. So I want you, when you do that, to put it in this form. If I am, and then, you know, if I am this or if I am that, comma, then I'll survive. But you can say whatever form it takes for you. Then I'll be safe, then I'll be loved, then I'll be accepted, then they'll approve of me, they'll like me, whatever. However it comes up for you. I'd like us then to be moving one more time into breakout groups, and I'm going to give you two questions that I'd like each person to share their responses with their partner, and then we'll switch and have the partner share their responses to the same two questions. Those questions are, what were the rules of my family? What were the rules of my family? And second question, what unlivable contracts might I have made? What unlivable contracts might I have made? So if each person took 5 minutes, one person talks about these two questions for 5 minutes and switch to the other person for 5 minutes, and then we could come back into the whole group and debrief the whole thing together. I would love to hear back from at least a few people if anything is really alive about what we just did that you would like to share.
I think a contract that I made that is still with me gets in the way of my remembering what the rules might have been or what went on back there, because I have ended up with a contract that seems to be that it is unsafe to feel my feelings and to feel any sensations other than those that are unrelated to emotions. I can feel, I'm sitting on the chair, I can feel pain and itching and
right.
This kind of thing. Yeah.
Right, but you don't feel the actual emotional feelings.
No, I don't.
Right. Mm-hmm. Would the contract be something like, I know this wouldn't have been in words. You see, some of these are pre-verbal, or many of them will be, but if you just try to figure out as best we can with words, is something like, if I don't feel anything, I might survive? Is that your sense of this kind of a contract?
I think so. I think there's a good possibility that it was, I had a sick little brother that I couldn't react to. I was not permitted to react to any teasing from him or anything, and I had to squelch my reactions, and so it got all generalized to squelching all of my feelings and all of my awareness of my feelings. And that's just speculation, sort of. I don't have a real clear memory that that's what went on.
Right. You can only go on what your inner knowing tells you, because very few children have clear memories of their whole childhood. That's far more common than we have been led to believe. So thank you very much for that.
I was surprised at how often the word safe was showing up on the end of my sentences. I'll be safe. And this awareness, and I loved just now when you said I'll survive, it's almost like I can feel something at the core down my midline that wanted to keep everything together. And so it meant like suppressing needs and looking around. From the time I was like, I think in a crib, it almost feels like looking around
mm-hmm.
to read the airwaves to be safe. And then the word survive is even more potent. I believe there's a lot of sadness so far in this call, and some of it is realizing why authenticity couldn't be there and the cost
of
it.
Exactly. Thank you so much for that. Well, I guess I'd like to hear from anybody who would like to just say anything that's up for you right now.
I think we have a lot of commonalities.
Mm-hmm. I'm connected with the sadness.
Yeah. I could feel the sadness also. Just that first person saying, really feeling that how much all of us have shared in our upbringing, and we usually feel so alone with that. Anybody else?
You said, I'll never be enough, and I think I've carried that around a long time in my life. So I'm feeling humbled to sort of get rid of that.
Okay, great. We will definitely support you in shifting that to wherever it works much better for you.
Whenever I'm in my own misery or whatever, it feels like this is only happening to me. and I'm alone in my misery. But in hearing it, it gives me hopefulness. This is common. I can do something about it. You know, I can move from this.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What came up for me from this exercise is that you're born into this kind of energetic field of an affection and attention, and anything else feels kind of like a dissonance. And what's
yes.
sad is that then when the child has more reasoning abilities, they blame themselves.
Absolutely. I love how you said that, and I think that's a really lovely place to end today, because it so carries the theme that we're, thank you for that, that we're born into an energy field, and our system is geared to flourish when that energy is loving and bonded and unconditional, and that all gets very disrupted when there's other qualities of energy in the space. And that, unfortunately, also very common in the domination family life. So I would really, really like to thank all of you for joining in on this. And I myself am sitting here feeling like, oh my God, that went by so fast, but with a kind of sense of expectation to deepening this as we continue. I almost forgot to recommend two things. One is, we did not have a lot of time to work with unlivable contracts, so feel free to continue to explore that in terms of what the rules of your family were and what you may have internalized and how that may be living out in your present life. And the other is a recommendation of just a fantastic book that has a couple of short introductory, very easy to read chapters that capture a fair amount of the brain stuff. So, and then the rest of the book is these wonderful anecdotes of case after case of children. The book is called The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, and the author is Bruce Perry, P-E-R-R-Y. If you're a reader and you have interest in that, that's one I think that you will just love. And we mentioned Alice Miller, For Your Own Good, and it's one of my all-time favorites. That's it. And next time we'll be meeting our limbic systems, the part that takes over when old pain and trauma are triggered. And it's a wonderful acquaintance to have.